Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Moin moin liebe Leute, hier spricht Tara vom Podcast Tara sagt was und wie eine echte Feministin kann ich natürlich nicht kochen. Naja, nicht ganz. Ich mag kochen, aber das Ganze drumherum strengt mich an. Was koche ich heute und wieder neue Rezepte ausdenken und dann noch in den Supermarkt. Das Gute bei HelloFresh ist, dass du da jede Woche aus über 40 super Rezepten dir etwas aussuchen kannst und du kriegst alles so geliefert, wie du es brauchst. Und mit meinem Code FRESH24 könnt ihr in Deutschland bis zu 120 Euro sparen. Der Code ist für neue und ehemalige Kundinnen gültig. Testet es doch mal mit meinem Code FRESH24.
Wir alle wissen, dass Bewegung sehr wichtig ist. Für Selbstbewusstsein bis Achtsamkeit. Das ist der Grund, warum sich Elle und Nike auch für die dritte Staffel von Why I Move zusammengetan haben. Ein Podcast rund um das Thema Frauen, Wellness und natürlich Bewegung. Also gönnen Sie sich eine Pause, atmen Sie tief ein und hören Sie Why I Move.
My main safety concern when jumping in front of 10 charging 40-ton whales was that what they do is they blow bubbles in each other's faces, kind of bellowing threats at each other. They'll breach out of the water onto the backs of other whales, and males sometimes get killed in the process. So I was sort of worried that they'd just be so intent on what they're doing, these violent acts to each other, that I'd just kind of be collateral damage. My name is Roger Munns, and I'm an underwater cameraman. In 2008, I set off with a team from the BBC Natural History Unit to attempt to film one of the biggest fights in nature. Multiple male humpback whales compete with each other to become the mate of a female humpback. As far as I'm aware, no one had even attempted to film it for TV, so I definitely felt a huge sense of opportunity and also a lot of pressure that I and we had to deliver kind of on the promise that we'd made, which was that we could film the humpback heat run. So we landed in Tonga, kind of met with the rest of the team. Once we'd had our setup day, We headed out north and south, left and right, looking around. And it was early days, and we were seeing whales, which was really encouraging. Some mother and calf pairs, which we would get in and film, and had some really beautiful interactions. When you have an encounter with a mother and a calf, it's absolutely wonderful that the mothers will hang often down at sort of 10, 15, 20 meters. They're exhausted. They've been feeding their calf with milk for days on end, and they're not feeding. So they just hang there like kind of huge motherships. While the calves are the complete opposite, just like any young child or animal, they're playful. They're like puppies. So they kind of have the mind of a puppy dog, but in the body the size of an elephant. So they're just spinning around you and coming up and investigating you. And in the course of our shoot, they bumped into me and my safety diver, Jason, a couple of times, which was a bit nerve-wracking when you're bumped into by an elephant-sized puppy. We were setting off pretty early, so we'd get on the boat at dawn and we'd be coming back at dusk. About 12 hours on the boat every day. Jason, my safety diver, and I would sit on the back of the boat, kind of with our fins on, wetsuits on, camera would be resting beside me. you're looking backwards, mostly looking at your wake, so all the bubbles that your engine is pushing out, slowly disappearing into the distance, and you're sort of rocking from side to side, sometimes pretty roughly depending on the ocean state, which got pretty rough out in the open ocean. Probably two-thirds of the way through the shoot, so we're talking about day 13, day 14. When you're 14 days into an open ocean shoot like that, I kind of felt like I'd been on that boat forever. And every day was blending into the next, you know, I couldn't tell you what day 7 was like versus day 9. It was just all the same. You wake up, you get on the boat, you drive around, maybe you jump in a few times, film a couple of whales, get back on the boat, come back in, eat, sleep, and you're just repeating this routine, and it all just starts to sort of blend and blur into one. You start to think that it will never happen, because it hasn't happened, and you can't see the whales, and you just can't see any way that it will happen. So certainly, like, I think by day 13, day 14, I was starting to question whether we were going to be successful. I think it was day 17, and we set out as we always did. I think we may have taken a left turn that day. On the boat, we had a skipper, and we also had a spotter, a local Tongan spotter with incredible eyes. He saw the heat run before anyone else. When you actually see the frothing mass at the surface and these things breaching, jumping on top of each other, it's like the sea is boiling. It just looks white with foam and froth. You do start to question in your head, like, oh, did we really think this through? What, like... Was this genuinely a good idea? No one really had done this before. The idea of jumping in front of 10 charging 40-ton humpback whales. You know, I questioned it. Obviously, the boat gets very excited. You know, everyone is jumping around, shouting, calling out orders, prepping. While the chaos is going on around me on the boat, I'm sitting on the back, my wetsuit with my fins on, and I'm going through my pre-freedive process, which is really important because, yeah, I have to hold my breath, diving underwater on a single breath of air. I have to kind of slow down my body, slow down my breathing, slow down my heart rate, remain calm, remain focused, to give myself the longest possible time underwater. We had worked out a strategy whereby we would leapfrog the heat run with the boat, get out in front of it, and then I would drop in with my safety diver, Jason, and we would then swim into kind of an intercept path with the whales. It's hard, once you hit the water, I can't really see anything, because my eyes are at water level. So I looked at the boat and they'll be shouting and pointing in a certain direction. And that's the direction that I swim. And I swim and swim, and they're shouting further, further. And then once I reach the kind of the intercept position, then the guys are shouting at me, dive. So at that point, try and calm myself, and I take my final pre-dive breaths, some big mouthfuls, big lungful, and then I kick down. Swam down to roughly, I guess, 8 or 9 meters deep. All I can see at that point is blue water. So I would look up to see Jason, my safety diver, who's floating at the surface watching me. So I'd look up to him. He would be pointing towards the whales, so I'd know which way to orient myself. So I'm just hanging in the water. I'm looking around me. I'm just trying to make out any shape, any texture. Throughout Tonga, you go in anywhere in the water and you can hear whales singing. I know there was whale song all the time, right? And whale calls and whale song. But in my mind, those moments where I'm hanging in the water, waiting for the whales to come. It's just completely silent. So when I'm hanging there, I'm on a single breath of air. And then I have a little mantra that I kind of run through my head, which is just like, get it in focus, expose it properly, press record. Get it in focus, expose it properly, press record. Just to calm myself and just to tell myself what the simple things are that I have to do. Get it in focus, expose it properly, press record. Get it in focus, expose it properly, press record. Get it in focus. I just can't see anything at all. And that moment seems to go on. Time seems to stretch out. It seems to go on forever.
Get it in focus, expose it properly.
Get it in focus,
record.
Get it in focus.
Press record,
get it in focus,
get it in focus,
and you think, okay, the whales have gone down, or they've turned around, or you know, they've changed their path, I've missed them, and then suddenly they're there in front of you, and it happens like, you know, in an instant. It's like being faced by 10 trucks on a motorway. And you just hope that the drivers can see you and don't want to hit you. I'm kind of taken out of the moment at that time because I'm looking at the event through my tiny little like 4-inch viewfinder. And I think that actually helps give you like a false sense of security because there's a sort of a sense of unreality. Maybe it made me a bit braver. The whales are moving really fast and they're coming head on towards me, but it's three-dimensional. So some of them are above me. Some of them are already diving when they see me and dive kind of below me. And some of them are passing on my left or right. And then it happens and it's over and you're back up and you're like, oh, I want to do that again. Let's do it again. You know, straight back, call the boat, get on the boat and repeat and do it again and again. You know, we must have done 10 or 15 drops in that way over the course of 3 or 4 hours of tracking this heat run until it got to the point where we were so far offshore that we were risking not being able to get back before dark. And we basically had to leave them still going at it, still heading away from the island, and we had to turn back. Seeing that event, this huge battle royale of male humpback whales, was pretty amazing, but it was almost dwarfed just by the relief of the success of the filming trip. It was hard in that moment to kind of get some perspective on what we'd seen. And I think it was only when I saw some of the behind-the-scenes footage and I just realized how tiny I was in comparison to these animals. I mean, it was ridiculous. And you don't realize that when you're there in the moment and you're staring through a viewfinder. Then I think it kind of hit home what an amazing thing it was that we'd done. And what an experience it was. Filming the heat run definitely ignited something in me and broke down some barriers as to what, you know, I thought was possible and what I could do. Since then, I have definitely gone out of my way to film whales, and I've had some incredible experiences around the world with blue whales in Sri Lanka. I've been in the water with superpod of 100 sperm whales. I've filmed bowhead whales in the Arctic. Yeah, I certainly feel incredibly privileged to be able to do what I do, have these encounters with these huge sentient creatures.
Next on Obsessed with the Quest for Discovery, Victor Vescovo explains his journey to explore the deepest depths of the oceans.
Probably the low point of our entire expedition occurred above the Puerto Rican Trench. when we were trying to dive the submersible for the first time to over 8,000 meters, and we were having technical issues with the submersible. It was a prototype design. No one had ever built anything like this before, and we had several electrical and a couple of other types of issues, and we were in danger of actually canceling the whole expedition. I gave the team 36 hours to try and sort out the issues and make the submersible work and have it be safe. And to their immense credit, Triton Submarines and their great crew were able to figure out the key problems and solve them, and I was able to dive successfully to the bottom of the Puerto Rican Trench for the first time in history. The Five Deeps was a mission to reach the very bottom of all five of the world's oceans. And it was a particularly challenging mission because no human had been to the bottom of four of our world's five oceans, and the deepest had only been visited twice in human history. I think I've always been an explorer at heart, because that came to the fore when my parents did perhaps the most dangerous thing they ever did, which was give me my first bicycle when I was about 7 years old. I think that the last they saw of me for quite some time. In the desire to just explore my neighborhood, my city, and then beyond my city was something that was just deeply ingrained in me. And as I grew older, I think I went further and further and eventually started building vehicles to take me places that no one else had been either. The Five Deeps, as we call them, are the five deepest points in all the world's five oceans. That would be the Puerto Rican Trench in the Atlantic, the Factorian Deep, named after my submersible, the limiting factor, in the Southern Ocean, the Java Deep in the Indian Ocean, the Challenger Deep in the Mariana Trench in the Pacific, and the Molloy Hole, which we also called the Molloy Deep, in the Arctic Ocean. The Molloy Deep, the deepest point in the Arctic Ocean, was particularly challenging because it was the shallowest of the five deeps. So there were a lot of canyons, even overhanging rock. And when you're in a submersible and you can't see very well, you want to get very close to these unusual features, but you also have to be very, very careful because you don't want to run the sub into any sharp rocks or anything that could entangle the sub or damage its components. It always seems like you're either too far away or you're too close. The beginning of the Five Deeps expedition effort began all the way back in 2015 with the idea to build this craft and undertake the mission. The first dive occurred in December of 2018, and we completed the fifth dive in the Molloy Deep in the Arctic Ocean in August of 2019. So it took about 10 months to do the Five Deeps expedition. The problem involving the battery that had an issue was on the Tonga Trench dive, which is the second deepest place on the ocean. So there was actually a large discharge of current, let's just call it a fire, in one of the batteries that was outside of the pressure vessel. It was attached to the submarine when I was at the second deepest place on the planet, 4 hours from the surface. So that was a situation where I had to take care of the problem myself, or I could have had a more serious problem. The Challenger Deep was first dived in 1960 using the Bathyscaphe Trieste, piloted by Captain Don Walsh and Jacques Picard. And then it was dived in 2012 by film director James Cameron, the first solo dive there. I made the fourth descent in 2019, but then made the first repeated descent in the same vehicle as an individual, and I've now since been down 15 times. Before we developed our technology, more people had walked on the moon than had been to the bottom of the ocean. For the first Challenger Deep dive, I was fortunate that I had a good night's rest, but had to get up quite early, about 6 a.m., and then began the process of personally checking the submersible externally and internally to make sure everything was all right. And that's when we started the process of me getting into the submersible, crawling through the trunk and getting into the pressure vessel, closing the hatch, and then the vessel using a large crane to put the submersible into the water. And then checking the systems again, and then getting the all clear to begin the descent. After going below the surface of the ocean, it gets very, very quiet. It's also quite cold in the submersible. It's freezing cold at the bottom of the ocean, and you're in a large metal sphere. And so the temperature gets down into the 5 to 10 degrees Celsius range. And it gets dark very, very quickly. And then it begins a 4-hour descent to the bottom. That is a constant effort to check all of the systems of the sub, checking in with the surface by voice communications, using an acoustic modem every 15 minutes to let them know that I was okay. You're always like a helicopter pilot, as I've been trained, to listen to your craft, because it will tell you very quickly if something isn't quite right just by listening. As one is descending to the bottom of the ocean, you really don't have any sense of motion. In fact, you're descending at over a meter per second. What you do see is that it's getting darker, slower and slower, and then eventually it becomes completely black. And then at about 2,000 meters, once in a while one can see creatures in the ocean winking at you like fireflies. And most people don't realize it, but animals in the water communicate using bioluminescence, by using light. But as you get deeper and deeper, no light at all penetrates, and it is completely and utterly black. It's the blackest black you could ever see. Until you get to the bottom and you turn on all of your wonderful lights and you can see for about 30 meters what's in front of you. In the first 15 minutes of diving for the first time at the bottom of Challenger Deep, I had quite the punch to the gut when I saw a sharp right angle, and I knew that nature does not make sharp right angles. And as I move the submersible closer, I'm not 100% sure if it was plastic or not, but it probably was. It was just incredibly unfortunate that a piece of human contamination had gone to this incredibly remote place. I was surprised on my travels, and perhaps because I covered so much ground in my submersible that was capable of doing so, but I saw quite a bit of life. The first creature I saw at the bottom of Challenger Deep was actually something called a holothurian, or a sea cucumber. It had no pigmentation, so it was completely transparent. You could see its insides, and it didn't need pigmentation because there's no light there. And it was moving slowly along the seafloor, trying to find whatever food it could that had drifted all the way down from the top part of the ocean. Colonies of bacteria that one could see with the naked eye, that were almost like small tentacles growing out of the rocks. So they're living off of the methane seeping from the rocks and the minerals in the rocks. We actually did quite a bit of science on our dives. We, of course, were taking loads of film from all the different cameras mounted not just on the submersible, but on the robotic landers that would go down with the submersible. They would just drop from the ship all the way to the bottom and stay there. And they also had beta traps, so fish and amphipods and other things would come visit them, and we would film them. And simultaneous to that, the ship would be mapping all of the area, and many of the places, if not all the places that we went to, had never been thoroughly mapped before. We were finding canyons and seamounts, so it was a whole variety of scientific things that we did in terms of capturing biological samples, mapping the geology, sampling the water for contamination and temperature and salinity. It was quite a major scientific endeavor for the whole 4 years that we intensively dived the system. When you're at 11,000 meters, there's only one other submersible in the world owned by the Chinese government that can get down to that depth, and it's quite a production. So really, you're on your own. You have to self-rescue if there's a problem. The most anxious moment is when you flip the switch to drop the weight that is keeping you down at the bottom. Once that's released and you can feel yourself ascending, you know that in 4 or 5 hours you'll be at the surface. On the ascent, you feel actually quite comfortable that you're going to make it to the surface because now you're much lighter. Once you get to the surface of the ocean, and you've been in the water now for 13 plus hours, and that's such a relief. And to see the sunlight coming into the water and making it into the viewports, you feel like you've come back home and that you really are safe. But you also feel a tremendous sense of satisfaction and achievement that you've just gone to one of the most remote places possible on this planet. It's like being an astronaut, just in the water. We continued the scientific mission in 17 deep ocean trenches over the following 3 years, all over the world. We circumnavigated the world twice. Half of our entire planet is still completely unexplored. Even when we know the complete surface of Mars and the Moon, we still don't know so much about our own planet. If there's life on other planets, it will probably bear far greater resemblance to what we saw in the Mariana Trench than anything that we see up here on land. Those very deep ocean trenches compose 2% of the world's surface, but they hold 40% of the water. And we still don't know completely how that affects the ability of the ocean to retain heat and to circulate ocean currents and have an effect on our climate on land. But the quest never ends. My ultimate goal is simply to continue the process of advancing high technology, particularly in marine science, and develop vehicles that will allow more people to dive as safely and even more capably in the future.
Wir alle wissen, dass Bewegung sehr wichtig ist. Für Selbstbewusstsein bis Achtsamkeit. Das ist der Grund, warum sich Elle und Nike auch für die dritte Staffel von Why I Move zusammengetan haben. Ein Podcast rund um das Thema Frauen, Wellness und natürlich Bewegung. Also gönnen Sie sich eine Pause, atmen Sie tief ein und hören Sie Why I Move.
Chasing Mountains is the story of five incredible mountaineers competing to become the first woman to climb all 14 of the world's highest mountain peaks, the so-called 8,000ers.
Pitting themselves against nature on the roof of the world.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.